Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Are you up for it?
For noise as something meaningful, and therefore I'm going to look where you would never have thought to look before, or where you would have thought it would have been useless to look.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll take your seats, please. Our tour is about to begin.
A sightseeing tour on the
noise.
To broaden man's knowledge of the world he lives in and the universe around him.
As an historian who's worked for 20 years on the topic of noise, the first thing that occurs to me is that for an historian, noise is information.
I want all the people to understand that it is understandable that people cannot possibly understand.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Well, okay.
My name is Hillel Schwartz. I'm a poet, a translator, a cultural historian, and a case manager. I just published last year a book called Making Noise, From Babel to the Big Bang and Beyond.
Making noise,
Big Bang, Big Bang. From Babel, Babel to the Big Bang, Big Bang. Big Bang. From Babel, Babel to the Big Bang, Big Bang, Big Bang.
Babel to the Big Bang and beyond.
Which in 900 pages of text and 350 pages of footnotes was an attempt to understand how not only the experience but the very definition of noise has changed over 2,500 years. And so I was invited not only to talk about noise, but also about a key proposition in my book, which was that noise itself is less a circumstance of the intensity of sound than it is a circumstance of the intensity of relationships.
The time is 1300.
Not only is itself is less a circumstance of the intensity of sound than it is a circumstance of the intensity of relationships. For me,
the particular interest came from realizing that since the mid-19th century, noise had acquired many non-acoustic references. There were some previous metaphorical references for noise, but in general, the shift that took place since the 1880s in the ability of people to define noise visually, to define noise statistically, to define noise in terms of stochastic processes, all of this led me to want to study how that transition occurred and what it eventually meant that we should talk about the background noise of the universe. Now, only the Brahmins, the Hindu sages, would ever talk about the background noise of the universe, but in the West, there wasn't such a thing as the background noise of the universe. What did it mean to say, let's get rid of that noise in our heads, let's calm down? These are rather modern concepts, and so I wanted to understand how, in the transition from the acoustic to the analogical to the metaphoric, noise took on so many other roles in our culture. Joel Schwartz, I'm a poet. As an historian who's worked for 20 years on the topic of noise, the first thing that occurs to me is that for an historian, noise is information. There is no necessary distinction. If you have a riot, the noise of the riot is definitely important to the historian. If you have complete silence, that is equally information. But the fact that something is thought of or spoken of as noise is itself information for an historian. Why are some people saying that this sound or these sound-making crowds are noise, rather than saying, oh, these are articulate spokesmen just speaking loudly? Or why are some people saying that the sound here is ugly and the sound here is beautiful? Well, these are culturally conditioned, historically conditioned judgments, which even change through one's own life, not just from generation to generation. When one is old, one has a wholly different set of presumptions, which are aesthetic, which are acoustic, which are otoacoustic, and that is how you actually hear through your ears. So all of these time-bound issues of sound come to the fore, in particular, for an historian, when noise is mentioned. People actually rarely go around saying, stop that sound. They only say, stop that noise. Moreover, people don't say to you, if you're singing beautifully, that was a beautiful sound, unless they're a sound engineer. Otherwise, they'll say that was beautiful music. So sound, actually, as a term, as a word, is much less useful to an historian than the words noise and music are, not simply because they are value-laden, but because they are historically bound in a certain context.
Time, present, and time, past are both perhaps present in time future. Time present and time past are both present in time future. Time present, time present, time past and time past perhaps are present, perhaps are present time future. Time present and time past. Time present. Time past, time present, and time past, time present, and time past, are both perhaps present and time future. Time future. Time future. Time future. Thank you.
When I was working on my book on noise, it was clear almost from the start that libraries don't index noise very well. They index music beautifully, but there are very few index words in books for noise, and there are very few libraries that had any sense of noise. Of course, libraries are supposed to be quiet anyway, so why would they be paying attention to noise? So it was clear to me that as an historian, it would challenge all of my skills to find instances of the experience of noise and the definition of noise outside of the world of musicians. But that was the delight, that was the wonderful challenge of studying sounds that are heard but go unheard in most of the historical record. So when I would go into, for example, a police museum in St. Louis, the librarian thought I would find absolutely nothing in a police museum about noise. But there are laws about making noise at different times of day. There are police sirens. There are surveillance cameras. There are laws about how one should not have a perfectly silent X or Y because that would be too dangerous. There are issues about honking your horn. All of this within the purveil of the woman who's the librarian of the police library, but she had never thought to look for it. So in the sense that noise is always heard, it's obtrusive, but it's always unheard in the record because it's thought of as not being meaningful. I was reversing the entire situation to say, no, I'm looking for noise as something meaningful, and therefore I'm going to look where you would never have thought to look before, or where you would have thought it would have been useless to look. I would actually recommend a book by a children's book author called The Quiet Noisy Book. The Quiet Noisy Book. Quiet Noisy Book. It is a book about a little dog who awakes in the middle of the night and hears a sound. It's a very quiet sound. So quiet, it's quieter than an ant walking, but he can still hear it and he wants to know what it is. So is it the sound of an elephant tiptoeing down the stairs? No, it's not that. Is it the sound of butter melting? No, but it's a very quiet sound, as quiet as a skyscraper scraping the sky. But what is that sound? the quiet, noisy book. This was the book that I learned by heart when I was 4 years old, and I always keep it in mind when I'm thinking about sound and noise, because the virtue of this book is not that the dog is waking and hearing a sound. The virtue of the book is that there is always a metaphor at hand to try to figure out what a sound is. When you get to the end of the book, the dog finally realizes what the sound is, and it is the sound of the sun coming up. I have talked in the past about what I call the almost inaudible. Our entire set of senses is geared to sensing change. We are very bad at sensing stability. After a while, anything that is the same is no longer within our sensory range. We just don't recognize it. So that sometimes the most frustrating but attention-getting sounds are those which are just within range of our hearing, but we can't quite make out anything intelligible from it. Like the little dog waking in the middle of the night. It's there, but what is it? So our sense of what is mysterious, our sense of what is extraordinary, our sense of what may be looming as danger, all of that comes from the slightest shift that we notice. Whatever that new and minor vibration might be, as soon as we notice it, that's when our minds work together with our memories, work together with our senses to try to figure out how to place that. And it is in the effort of trying to place something that one often comes upon or defines the extraordinary. If you have something happen to you and there was no effort on your part, very often, even if it has been created to impress you, it will never linger in your memory as long as that which you struggled to define, which was just within the range of your senses. Noise reflects off our relationship with all those beings we rub against. The noun termite stems from the Greek word terere, to rub or bore. So what sort of sounding exactly is going on inside our walls and floors, our furniture and doors? Certainly termites, with their nests and mounds, have what in German is called eine Stimmung, a tuning, a tonality of being, which we may chance to hear through their arboreal vibrations or their alarmed baking at nest edges. But do they also have a mind, a mood, a disposition, an atmosphere,
a voice, a music, a language, or an art. The San Diego painter and critic Manny Farber regretted using the phrase, but it has affixed itself like a fecal pellet in avant-garde rhetoric since 1962, termite art, by which he meant an art that isn't anywhere or for anything, that goes always forward, eating its own boundaries, and leaves nothing in its path other than the signs of eager, industrious, unkempt activity, with no sign that the artist has any object in mind other than eating away the immediate boundaries of his art and turning these boundaries into conditions of the next achievement. That was 1962. In 1959, 3 years before, the zoologist Pierre-Paul Grasset explained mound construction by African macro-termitine termites in terms of a new word that he coined, stigmergy, Greek for to incite to work or urge to exert. Stigmergy solves a problem posed by Maeterlinck. If individual termites have no overall guidance, no blueprint, no crew boss, how do they build such complex nests and mounds? Answer, instead of direct communication, genetic codes, or imitation, or even intuition, individuals influence each other's work by what they themselves have just done. In termite terms, a worker termite places one of its fecal pellets at some spot. Then, by way of a simple algorithm as innate as our own sense of cause and effect, subsequent workers stumbling on that pellet are stimulated to add or rearrange the pellets. The most rapidly growing structures are the strongest stimuli until they plateau at about 9 or 10 meters. Thus do chance, energy, excrement, assiduity, and the law of large numbers produce not only the structural integrity of deep subterranean nests and high mounds, but a system of tunnels and central chimney that establish an air circulation in every termite mound that keeps temperatures within 2 degrees centigrade, humidity at 90%, and carbon dioxide at 2.6 to 2.8% for the comfort of all in the nest, and even for their fungus gardens. With stigmergy, perhaps termites chewing through a beam arrive at how much to consume before they must leave and it collapses. So too, perhaps, with termite sound. The rhythms of their noises, even their stimmung, may be stigmergic, where one soldier, frightened or attacked, starts headbanging and neighbors join at rapid haphazard, oscillating across several frequencies according to the size of their mandibles and when they were last fed a good regurgitated meal. Now, I find online a termite television collective, a termite art blogspot, termite art film company, termite anti-ship missiles, but there is no termite architectural studio or termite sound studio. When the most remarkable aspects of termites are architectural and to my mind, or to my ear, sonic. As also to the ears of the Basoga people of Uganda, whose music for collecting and eating termites, the other white meat, by tricking them into a swarm is an imitative click stick away from sincerest flattery. Oddly, the honors for termites in architectural terms go to them as synonyms for moles or spies or saboteurs, people deeply embedded out of the limelight, nondescript, assiduous, silently listening in and eating away at the core of a secret or strategic operations or the underpinnings of a corporate edifice. These, in our mind, are the most treacherous of missing persons to the extent that they go unnoticed and unheard. But actual termites, half a centimeter long, in their unanimous loyalty to the nest, have no ideology, no arthropod malice or individual ambition. Whatever comes tumbling around them is entirely collateral damage. Maeterlinck was astonished and abashed by a loss of individuality so complete that collective survival is all, where every individual goes missing, every individual goes missing as an individual, uninvested in the ethics of suffering or quandaries of self. As found among snapping shrimp, ants, bees, wasps, and termites, scientists now call this eusociality, higher or perfected sociality. Although termites are not matriarchal, they otherwise manifest the same traits of eusocial species: cooperative care of the young, a division of labor, whereby sterile individuals care for the fertile, and a life cycle long enough for offspring to share the activities of the parental generation. Termite mounds and civilizations have been known to last at least 60 years. Was it an homage to the super organic eusociality of termites that Maurice Maeterlinck, as it turns out, plagiarized word for word pages of La Vie des Termites from a book by Eugène Marais, The Soul of the White Ant, an Afrikaner lawyer, poet, journalist, and naturalist whom Maeterlinck never mentions? What could plagiarism possibly mean to a termite? And if termite civilization not only predates, but prefigures our own with a precision Maeterlinck never foresaw, consider our network of fiber optic cables tunneling beneath continents, our magically responsive worldwide web, our enormous underground chambers of fiercely guarded, temperature and humidity controlled, physically huge, ever-hungry servers fed every second of every day by ever more extensive electrical grids that hum at near termite frequencies. If termite civilization prefigures our own, what earthly import could plagiarism have soon to any one of us? In conclusion, as veterans of sharp climatic shifts, architecturally gifted at coping with global environmental change over 100 million years, geared for robustness and self-healing, willing to sacrifice themselves for future generations, termites on this planet constitute twice the mass of the lump sum of living humans. To them, to termites, we humans likely register as just another noise in the walls, a noise that will not be missed.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.